the nihilist ultimately has to posit that there is either no reason for our existence, which seems completely ludicrous, or that there is some kind of reason, but it's completely arbitrary, which also just seems a bit bewildering. It is nicer to think that you are here for some kind of reason that's written into the rules of the universe than that it all is just a happy or unhappy accident. My name's Alex O'Connor. I'm the host of the Within Reason podcast. I think I'm best described as a philosophy YouTuber and former edgy atheist.
Understanding nihilism and the human condition.
Nihilism comes in many forms, and depending on the context, can mean many different things. But most broadly, it's probably the lack of belief in, or belief that there is no such thing as, an objective purpose to life or to the actions that we commit and the behaviors that we portray within life. Whenever anybody acts in any way, when I pick up a glass of water to have a drink, when I walk to a bus stop or something, there will be a reason why I've done that. These kinds of behaviors don't just spring up ex nihilo. They exist for some kind of reason. And so if you ask me why it is that I'm, you know, reaching my arm over there, it might be because I'm trying to pick up a glass of water. Or why am I doing that? I don't just do that randomly. Well, because I'm thirsty. Okay, well, why am I thirsty? Well, now we're kind of into some biological science. You might say, well, it's been a while since I've last had a drink. And then you might describe what it is about my biology that causes thirst, and you might even give an evolutionary explanation for why it is that we've developed this sensitivity to thirst. And eventually this kind of has to bottom out somewhere. But as soon as we're in this level of like biological science, which seems to be kind of outside of my own volition and desire and control, I suddenly realize that if the reason I'm reaching my arm over right now is ultimately speaking because of some evolutionary principle that I had no control over, that's just a result of animals fighting for survival, then my reaching my hand over there kind of feels a bit silly now. It feels like I'm like beholden to something which is not reasonable, is not some kind of, you know, God-given purpose. There's nothing good about drinking the water or anything like that. I'm just sort of following my evolutionary drives. And a process like that, for a lot of people, will feel quite devoid of meaning because you realize that you're just beholden to your sort of animalistic instincts, essentially, with almost everything you do. The thing that the nihilist recognizes is that the values he or she holds are not grounded in anything other than their own preferences or aesthetic preferences. So to be a nihilist is not to it's not to have no desire. It's not to have no motivation to act. A lot of people think that if you lived like a nihilist, you'd sort of rot away in bed. Some nihilists may do that, and I think there is actually a correlation, a strong correlation between philosophical nihilism and practical depression. However, nihilism is not about the actual consequences or the things that you're doing. It's about the purpose behind them. It's about the meaning behind them. And so, you know, suppose that you're feeling thirsty. I could explain to you that the only reason you're feeling thirst is because of some animalistic drive that you had no control over. And you might go, wow, that makes this all a bit ridiculous, doesn't it? But you're still thirsty. You still have that desire. You still have that value of you know, quenching your thirst, and so you'll still do that. And the same applies in all areas of life, including art and music and poetry, but also including relationships, friendships, that kind of stuff. You're still going to want to do those things, but the nihilist is someone who sort of takes a bird's eye view of it and realizes that it's all a little bit meaningless. It's like, you know, Camus famously described in the Myth of Sisyphus, this person who suddenly recognizes the structure of their day, you know, waking up, having breakfast, getting in the car, going to work, taking a break, eating some food, going back home, eating some food, going to sleep, starting again. And you sort of start to notice that you're doing this. And it's not anything about what you're doing. It's realizing, taking a step back and realizing that there's no meaning to any of this. There's nothing more than just my doing it. It doesn't go any deeper than that. Meaning, I think, is used synonymously with purpose. To have meaning is to have some kind of purpose. And purpose is something like reason to act or reason to be. So to have meaning or to have purpose, I think, is to have some kind of reason to either act, if you're talking about the meaning in an action, it's the reason to act in that way. If you're talking about the meaning of or in life, it's the reason to live, or the reason that we are alive, right? Now, like I said before, there always will be some kind of reason, but that reason will be contingent on something else. So the reason why I'm reaching my hand is because I want to get the water. But the reason why I want the water is contingent on something else, that is, that I'm thirsty. And the reason that I'm thirsty is contingent on something else. So to find an objective meaning at the root of life would mean finding a non-contingent reason to act or to be. There would just need to be a self-justifying principle where if you ask, but why, the answer and the truthful answer would be, it just is, or that why is an inappropriate question to ask any further. For there to be something for this to bottom out in, it will either have to bottom out in something completely arbitrary, which feels meaningless to people because it could have easily been something else, or this contingent chain of reasoning just essentially goes back forever, which seems implausible, or it terminates in something which is self-justifying. And when people say that they found their meaning in life, I think a lot of the time they found that self-justifying principle. For some people, their meaning in life might be the raising of their children. And if you ask them, why are you getting out of bed to go to work? Why are you doing that? To make money? Why? To provide for my family? Why? To bring up my children healthily? Why? Because I want my children to be healthy. Why? What do you mean, why? That's it. That's what it's about. And the philosopher might look at that and say, well, you know, you should still probably ask why, as a point of interest. Why do you care about that? But in practice, that moment that you reach where that question why just seems inappropriate, that's where you've bottomed out. And if you find some kind of self-justifying principle that ultimately motivates most of your actions, it's what you sort of have in the back of your mind when you're doing anything. And for most people, it probably is relational. It's probably got to do with children or spouses or something like that. For the religious, it will be God. Everything they do, even if they don't cognize it all the time, will be for the glory of God. You know, if you ask them to proactively analyze what they're doing, well, you know, why are you doing this? Why are you sat here doing an interview with people? Ultimately, they would say something like, well, you know, it's all for the glory of God. You know, everybody will have that self-justifying principle somewhere at the basis of their thinking. And if you're a secular person, if you're an atheist, it will likely be something else. I might say that, well, I really enjoy doing this kind of thing. I think it's a meaningful pursuit because I like, you know, discussing big questions. And if somebody says, well, why are big questions in life important? You know, somebody might just say, what do you mean? Of course they are. That's almost the definition of importance. Now, you can pick a hole with that, and a nihilist will. They'll say that you can always go deeper, and you will realize that ultimately it's just preference, which is why the nihilist thinks that there's no objective meaning. But most people have some kind of self-justifying principle. It's just usually a subjective one. Objective meaning would look something like a reason to act that is self-justifying and not dependent on some kind of preference that you have. So if your foundational self-justifying principle is your care for your children, it seems quite clear that your care for your children is subjective. It's dependent on you. After all, you don't care about other people's children in the same way, and they don't care about your children in the same way. It seems like if you died and your children with you, there'd be no, like, this kind of principle wouldn't exist out there in the ether. It seems completely dependent on your circumstances and your preferences. It seems a bit crude to describe, you know, your care for your children as a preference, but broadly speaking, it is a kind of preference. You prefer the well-being of your children over the well-being of other children. And in fact, that's a lot of the time what caring for the well-being of your children is about. It's providing them with, you know, a roof over their head and a stable income, which oftentimes is to the detriment of other people who are competing for the same job, but you have this preference. But it seems quite clear that that is person dependent, right? Like, for there to be an objective meaning would mean that it is insensitive to preference. It would mean that even for somebody who just had different preferences, who just didn't want children, if caring for your children were the objective meaning in life, then if somebody said, well, you know what, I just don't want children, it's just not something that appeals to me, I think I wouldn't be a good parent, then you would say to them, you are wrong. You are literally incorrect about the meaning in your own life. And some people think this, But what they mean is something like, oh, I think that if you had kids, you'd actually like it. Right. But that's just saying that you predict that they will subjectively prefer it too. Right? Like to say it's objective would be even if you don't prefer it, even if you have children and actually hate the whole process and think, gosh, this is awful and terrible, your life will still be more meaningful, even if you don't think it is. It would have to be something which provides meaning completely independent of your preferences of how you actually feel about it is about what it is that you're doing, if that makes sense. If meaning just means a reason to act or a reason to be, then of course, ultimately, I do think there is some kind of literal explanation for why we behave in the way that we do. And that will be objective in the sense that that will be the driving force behind our behaviors, whether we like it or not. So if you are an atheist materialist, you might think that evolution by natural selection has simply favored certain traits which produce certain behaviors. And I could say, literally speaking, the reason why you are behaving in this way, the reason why you have these preferences is because of this evolutionary trait, right? For most people, that's not very fulfilling, but literally speaking, that could be something like an objective meaning in the sense of it being an objective purpose. It is literally the purpose why we all act. But I think people want something a little bit more than that. They want something which feels like it's not quite just a reason to act. It's also something which feels worthwhile, that's somehow sort of justified by some universal principle. There's almost like a moral element that it's a good thing to be alive, that it's a good thing to live a meaningful life. And that kind of thing, I think, is very difficult to ground objectively unless you posit some kind of either supernatural design, or I suppose if you have a kind of philosophy of life or a metaphysic which says that there is some kind of teleology built into nature itself, which some people believe, but I struggle to grapple with. I think human beings naturally desire certain things and they have values. And I think this is probably an evolutionary trait. I mean, if you had two communities, one of which sort of just didn't care about anything, were completely apathetic, didn't care about their own children, didn't care to have children, didn't care to get out of bed, they're not going to survive for very long. So I think it is just literally the case that having some kind of sense of motivation for doing things in life is evolutionarily selected for. And so I think that most people are not actually fundamentally apathetic. Even people who seem apathetic actually have certain values. They value their own comfort, for example. Like if you sort of wake up and you just want to go back to sleep, that's not apathy. That's having a different value to the kind of value that would get you out of bed. You know, you value your comfort, you value sleeping. And so most people have these kinds of values. Nihilism doesn't remove values. It analyzes values and finds them to be essentially groundless, or if they do have a ground, the ground is within the subjective preferences of people. And so, like, I understand why, I mean, nihilism might make you act in a way that would be viewed as apathetic. It might make you a bit depressed, for example, and it might mean that you lay around a bit more and you have less motivation for doing the things you formerly enjoyed, all of those things that come along with depression. But you'll still have literal values. You will not enjoy your own pain. You will, if hungry, you will feel that hunger, whether or not you choose to satisfy it. You will have experiences that you want when experienced and experiences that you don't want when experienced, which I think is a good definition of pleasure and pain. And so what does nihilism do then? It just removes the meaning in those values. And so I sort of like to imagine that the person who is suffering, it's helpful to think of a person who's suffering, but is not a nihilist. You could have the worst life in the world. You could be depressed. You could be upset every single day. You could think your life is going terribly. But you could believe that there's some kind of reason. You could believe that there's a meaning behind it. Maybe you're religious. Maybe you believe in reincarnation, whatever, such that you're suffering, but you're not a nihilist. To be a nihilist is to suffer and suffer all the more from the recognition that the suffering is meaningless. So in principle, you could also be really happy. You could be having the best time in the world and be a nihilist, so long as you recognize that happiness you're feeling is completely meaningless. It's there's no reason for it. You're just feeling it. You just exist and you're feeling a certain thing and that's it. In practice, nihilism tends to make people more sad than happy. But as a philosophy, let's say, a philosophy of life, there's no inconsistency with being a very motivated, very happy, very content person who yet realizes that there's no meaning behind any of it. There is the fact that most people, literally speaking, do feel meaning in life. And it does seem a little bit bold to say that everybody who reports that is essentially either lying or deluding themselves. That seems bold. It seems a little arrogant and too confident. Not to say that that makes it false, but I think you should be aware of how radical a claim that is, of course. But also there does seem to be this universal compulsion towards meaning. It's like, obviously there is this universal compulsion to think that there is some reason why we're all here. Now, like I said before, that could be explained through evolutionary self-selecting pressures. But in a way, you might just say that that's kind of enough, because the only thing that matters is that I feel as though there is objective meaning. You know, like that might just be enough for people, in the sense that nihilism as a lived philosophy that like informs the way that you behave, you might just sort of accept the fact that everybody universally has this drive and treat it as if it were objective. In the same way that, like, if you're trying to work out what color to paint a house, and, like, color is completely subjective, but if it just so happened that everybody, for some evolutionary reason, preferred the color blue, like, absolutely everybody just, in fact, preferred the color blue, you might treat it as an objective fact that blue is the best color to paint the house. And in that context, that might become a meaningful statement, even though you recognize it's not technically objective, it's just universally subjectively true. But in practice, that sort of works the same as an objective truth, if you know what I mean. So you would paint the house blue, and if anybody said you should paint it another color, you might be able to say to them, you're kind of wrong, even though you're just dealing with preferences. So the universality of felt meaning or desire for meaning or assumption that there is meaning might be enough to raise a few eyebrows when it comes to nihilism. Nihilism is often seen as a kind of response to the decline of religion, you know, and you get thinkers like Nietzsche, you get thinkers like Emile Cioran, and then a bit later on, you get your existentialists and your absurdists, you get your Sartres and your Camus, right? But this goes way further back. Like, nihilism is not a new philosophy in response to the decline of religion. I think that religions emerge as a response to nihilism. I think it's the other way around. One of the still greatest expositions of nihilism that can be found in the printed word is the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament. Just this nihilistic outpouring. Meaningless. Everything is meaningless, says the teacher. But Ecclesiastes takes us through the reflections of this man, this anonymous author. Some have tried to identify him, but it doesn't really matter who it is. We know that he was a great man, a king. He lived an illustrious life, but he saw no meaning in it. And he keeps coming back to this word, hevel, which means literally something like wind, right? And so it's translated as vanity by the King James. Vanity of vanities. Everything is vanity. I've heard some exegetes think that the best modern translation of that word, hevel, in Hebrew, is actually absurd, in alignment with Camus' rubbing up of our expectations against the great iconoclast of reality, which just shatters all of our expectations. But meaningless, everything is meaningless, is one translation. Absurd, everything is absurd, is my favorite. Because he's describing these things. He's like, I denied my eyes no pleasure that they saw. If I wanted something, I took it. I drank wine, I partied, I lived life. But in the end, I saw that it was all hevel. It was all just wind. It's just nothing. It just happens, and then it's gone. And it doesn't mean anything. And clearly, whoever penned this text is struggling deeply with the exact same nihilistic themes that we talk about today. And for him, this is a piece of religious scripture. So there's this undertone. He keeps saying that under the sun, there is nothing. There's no meaning. There's no purpose to any of this. It's where we get the phrase, you know, nothing new under the sun. You know, under the sun is this phrase that keeps showing up in Ecclesiastes. And some have suggested that this is supposed to indicate that on earth, separate from the heavenly realm, there's no ultimate purpose to this. But interestingly, at the very end of Ecclesiastes, there's this passage where someone is, I mean, we've heard the teacher speak, Kohelet. We've heard this teacher speak and talk about how meaningless everything is. And then at the end, there's a commentary on this teacher's sort of treatise. And it says that everything he said was upright and true. Everything he said was correct, essentially. But the solution is this, fear God and keep his commandments. And there's no explanation as to why that would solve the problem. There's no like mechanism as to what that would change. But the most interesting thing is that it seems to suggest that everything that this guy was saying was true, that it is all just wind, but that somehow by just fearing God and keeping his commandments, you have somehow solved the problem. I don't think that that's a very satisfying solution, but then I think that that is the great theme of nihilistic literature. People try for a kind of solution, but ultimately, for me at least, they seem relatively unsatisfying. Fast forward thousands of years and you get Albert Camus' Myth of Sisyphus, which famously ends with this idea of imagining Sisyphus happy. Maybe that does it for you. I don't know what it does for me. But yeah, Nietzsche is often associated with nihilism, not a nihilist himself, of course, but discusses a lot of nihilistic themes. And then the existentialists are the sort of go-to figures for discussions of modern nihilism. In fact, Camus is celebrated for the starkness of the opening line of The Myth of Sisyphus, that there is one serious philosophical question, and that is suicide. He says everything else, you know, how many dimensions there are to space, you know, whether abstract numbers exist, all of that is secondary. The most foundational question is whether or not you're going to, as he once put it, have a cup of coffee or kill yourself today. You know, those are kind of your options. So nihilistic literature, so to speak, is a broad span. But literally, I think it begins with, I think that the coin is, the term is popularized by Turgenev's novel, Fathers and Sons. Although that's a more, I think that's a more restricted use of the word nihilism. It's more culturally relevant to Russia, the Russia that he was living in. But that's sort of where we get the term from. And it's in novelistic form. Interestingly, this often shows up in narrative, even in the book of Ecclesiastes. It's sort of telling a story. It's broadly speaking, most people will know there's this distinction between the so-called analytic philosophy, the if P then Q and logical fallacy and modus ponens. And on the other side, you've got the so-called continental philosophy, which is more narrative, it's more poetry, it's more grasping at ideas, but not directly. So this is where you have your existentialists, but also your novelists. You have your Dostoevskys and your Tolstoys, and you have your poets, and that's all sort of on that side. And the nihilistic literature, at least the stuff that people care about, is almost exclusively on the continental side, because it does seem to be something that resists discussion in abstract terms. It's very personal. It's very narrative. And it involves, you need to sort of involve yourself in the story of life in order to even understand what the problem is. I mean, you can imagine speaking to an alien. If you sort of tried to describe to an alien or an AI what nihilism is, and you say like, well, the problem is, you know, I get up and I go to work and I just don't know why I do it. And the alien might be like, well, yeah, you do. You do it to get money and to get a job. And yeah, but like, why do I do that? Well, because otherwise you'd be on the street and you'd be suffering. But why? Well, you just, you know, it's just built into you don't like suffering. That's like a definition of suffering. You just don't like suffering and you're trying to avoid it. Yeah, you're right. But it's just sort of, there's something, gosh, I wish there was more, you know? And the alien's like, what do you mean? More what? Like more pleasure? No, not more pleasure. Just like, I wish there were like a reason. It'd be actually quite difficult to just explain in plain terms. It's almost like it's a problem that can only be understood by someone who lives it. Whereas you could easily explain to that alien the concept of modus ponens. You know, the alien probably wouldn't have a problem with that as long as it's got a rational mind. But nihilism is something that we need to experience ourselves and explore through narrative. I am brutally agnostic about almost everything. And in fact, if somebody ever asks me how I might console myself in the face of these existential woes, genuinely, at least personally, it is in agnosticism. It's in the fact that I do not know the first thing about about why any of this exists. Of course I don't, you know? And sometimes people ask me in a context on a podcast or on a stage or something, implicitly as if I'm going to have some answer, as if I've like worked it out and I'm going to be able to communicate that to people. Like there's just no way. This is obviously a deeply personal story that everybody has to live individually. And I'm like doing the same thing, right? And I'm interested in philosophy, so I might have read something that helps to elucidate a concept, or I might be able to put a word on something that you've been thinking but didn't know was, you know, also thought by other people. But we're doing the same thing here, and ultimately I have absolutely no idea what the ultimate answers are. And so that kind of consoles me, because like if you're a more certain nihilist, I can understand why that would be very upsetting. If you really just believe that there's no meaning to any of this, then I can see why that would cause you some trouble. But personally, that's just not something that I strongly believe. I think it's plausible. I think there's a lot of it's quite an attractive view in many respects. You look at the level of suffering of animals in the history of the world, and you look at the seeming arbitrariness of the world around us, the way that the environment and the organisms within it seem to just sort of almost randomly evolve according to literal just battles for survival. It all just seems a little bit like this is all just accidental and meaningless. But then on a more fundamental level, it just seems strange to suggest that it's all just happening for literally no reason. That seems implausible to me too. So I don't really know how to fully make sense of that. And that consoles me. It's the same on the religious question, you know? It's much easier to be consoled. I mean, if you believe in God, you might be terrified because you're constantly worried about going to hell. If you're an atheist, you might be terrified because you think that this is the only life you have and that it's ultimately meaningless. If you're somewhere in the middle, you kind of just feel like, you know, you'll cross that bridge when you come to it, you know? Yeah, like nihilism is an upsetting thing to think about. It would be a sad reality. And so if you're certain of it, if you really are convinced that that's the case, I can see why that would be quite upsetting. Agnosticism literally does just, it's not like I'm choosing to be an agnostic in order to console myself. I just genuinely don't know what the truth of the matter is. And that just doesn't allow me to get really upset. It's almost like, you know, I don't know if it's going to rain on my wedding day. It's like, so long as I have no real conviction that it is going to rain, it's going to be very difficult for me to get like upset about the rain spoiling my wedding day, right? Like I literally just can't be upset about that unless I've got some reason to think that it's going to happen. Of course, there's literal reason to think this. It's plausible that it will rain on my wedding day, but that's not quite enough. You have to actually be convicted of it in order to be upset by it. And I suppose I'm just not convicted of nihilism. But that's not to say that I think it's false. It's just to say that there's a lot of room for doubt there. A lot of people don't realize the extent to which their emotions are influencing their thinking. Everybody likes to think that they are thinking objectively and rationally and with a sober mind, but our minds are never sober from emotion. And so when you sort of develop a philosophical view, it's always going to be informed by the way that you feel. So a lot of people think, you know, I'm depressed because I'm a nihilist. But I think without realizing it, a lot of the time, it's actually the case that people are nihilists because they're depressed. It goes the other way around. Nobody is ever convinced, like, out of nowhere of a philosophical position, right? Like, you read a philosopher and they will put something in such a way that makes you go, huh, yeah, you know what? I think that makes sense. And that's usually because they are kind of putting something into words or systematizing something which you already kind of knew. In fact, if you open Wittgenstein's Tractatus, the very first line of the introduction, it says something like, this book will be completely useless to anybody who doesn't already agree with its contents. He just admits that the reason he's really writing this is to elucidate something that hopefully his readers had already kind of independently come to. I think that happens all the time, which is also why, by the way, if you've ever tried to get into philosophy, you might look up like the 50 greatest philosophers of all time. I'm really interested. I want to see, you know, what I can learn. And it will say, okay, well, one great philosopher is Jean-Paul Sartre. And so you're like, okay, I'll give that a go. And you pick it up and you read it and you're just like, I don't get it. I don't understand. Not only do I not understand the context, like even when I looked up the Spark Notes and I got what he was talking about, and it just doesn't make sense to me. I'm not impressed. Like, why is this so famous? And it's because you've just plucked it out of nowhere. Whereas if you've had like a million conversations with people and Jean-Paul Sartre is a name that has come up every now and again, such that you've heard of him and such that just because it so happens that you're in like conversations and you're in situations that suit his name coming up from people who know who he is, chances are that if you then go and read him, you're actually going to enjoy what he's saying because there's some reason he keeps coming up. So when people ask me for a recommendation of what to read philosophically, I literally tell them to just read what they've heard of, because there's a reason why you've heard of those philosophers, because they're the people who've come up in the kind of context that you're obviously already interested in. And I think it's important to recognize that you're not going to be convinced out of nowhere of a philosophy that you don't already have sort of one foot in. And so for that reason, I think that our predisposition towards the world will influence the kind of philosophies which are attracted to us. I mean, like all of the nihilistic literature, all of the famous existential or nihilistic literature, if you handed that to a confident Christian, they're not going to be convinced by it. If you hand it to somebody who hasn't really thought about the issue, but maybe has some sort of nihilistic undertones to their life, they might read that and go, yeah, he's got a point, right? It's going to be more attractive if you're already kind of attracted to it before you've interacted with the text. I do think it's not just that. I mean, I just think it's worth pointing out that any kind of radical abandonment of philosophical consolation and principle is going to bring with it distress. But it's not just that, because nihilism is also just quite a upsetting thing for a lot of people. Like, I mean, it is nicer to think that you are here for some kind of reason that's written into the rules of the universe than that it all is just a happy or unhappy accident. I think it's just a nicer kind of philosophy. But I think we ought to be more suspicious of philosophies which are more attractive to us. Not because they're less likely to be true, but because we are more likely to accept them on less evidence, because we want them to be true. And so I think we need to recognize that bias and be careful of it. But it does also seem completely bewildering that we would just exist for absolutely no reason. I mean, the nihilist ultimately has to posit that there is either no reason for our existence, which seems completely ludicrous. There needs to literally be a reason why things exist. Or that there is some kind of reason, but it's completely arbitrary, which also just seems a bit bewildering. I mean, whatever is the answer to the grand mystery of why anything exists at all, it seems a little unsatisfying philosophically to say that it just could have gone the other way and there could have just been nothing. It seems a little, well, on the surface, it seems a little implausible. And so there is an inherent implausibility to nihilism too that people will wrestle with. And whether you are more convinced by the implausibility of meaning in life or the implausibility of it all just happening for no reason, I think will ultimately depend on your emotional state.
Want to support the channel? Join the Big Think Members community, where you get access to videos early, ad-free.